Welcome to the Matt Travis Podcast on Liberty Talks Media. Today, I'm talking with Georgie Borman.
What's up, guys? Welcome to the podcast. Today, I have on Georgie Borman. She is a writer for The Federalist, as well as she has her own podcast. It's on hiatus at the moment, but there's a lot in the archives that you can probably find called 180 Cast. And in that, she talks with people who have changed their views on a particular political issue to the exact opposite viewpoint, and she discusses with them how they came about to that viewpoint change. You can find her on Twitter at
Georgie underscore Borman.
Okay, I thought it was an underscore. Couldn't remember if it was an underscore or not. So Georgie underscore Borman on Twitter. You can find her again at The Federalist. If you just search Georgie Borman, The Federalist on Google, you can find all of her articles there. And we'll be going over a couple of them today, so I'll link those in the description as well. But yeah, is there anything you would want to add as far as what you do, how you came to talk about some of the subjects we're going to talk about today, like the pro-life movement, COVID, Christianity, those sorts of things?
Yeah. So I grew up in the church, and I'm a believer. And so everything that I talk about, from politics to culture, is obviously influenced by that and from that perspective. But I've covered, like, over the past 6 years writing for The Federalist, I've covered a vast spectrum of topics. But what I always keep coming back to, and what I think that I've been called to talk about most, is the things that are from womb to tomb. So from abortion all the way to physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia, those life and death topics are stuff that I think is very important and that I cover pretty frequently. And I know we're going to be talking about some of that today.
Yeah. So you have quite a few articles on that. You've talked about that on Twitter quite a bit, and I think you have some really good insights on all that. So that's actually a good segue into our first topic today. Because one of the main things that I want to discuss with you about is this notion in the pro-life movement that women are victims, and therefore they shouldn't, even if abortion were to be made illegal, even if we were to get a bill passed that said, okay, it's completely illegal, or it's illegal up to, you know, past 6 weeks or something like that if they were to get an illegal abortion after that point, that they shouldn't be prosecuted because our culture still teaches them things about abortion that are untrue, and therefore they are a secondary victim, and so they're not fully responsible in the way that other forms of first degree murder would be responsible. So to kind of dig into this, I want to read a comment that Ben Shapiro had made. I think he was some university. And he was answering a question from somebody who was challenging him on his pro-life position, and trying to make the argument that it's inconsistent to say that you wouldn't prosecute women. And they were doing it to demonize him. But I actually think they're partially right in that you shouldn't feel demonized if you believe that and you're pro-life, because there's a good reason. But I'll go ahead and read the quote here, and then you can kind of comment on it and give your thoughts on it. So he says, Ben Shapiro, answering a question, says, I do not think that women should be put on trial for a couple of different reasons. One is, I don't think it is effective in deterring abortion for women to be put on trial for killing the unborn. The second reason is because, unfortunately, I think that we as a society have gotten to such a point that an entire generation have been indoctrinated to believe that a baby is a polyp. And so when they remove it, I'm not sure that there is the necessary mens rea, the criminal intent necessary for prosecution. The typical pro-life position is that the woman is a victim in abortion nearly as much as the baby. That's probably my biggest, the thing that I take most issue with, is that it's a victim nearly as much as the baby. But he continues on, there is an entire abortion industry that is geared towards teaching women that babies are not babies and that getting a baby aborted is in fact a betterment of their life. So no, I'm not in favor of prosecuting women for abortions. And then this might be from the same interview. I've also heard him say this. If a baby were outside the womb and you stuck it with a knife to the chest, you'd be charged with first degree murder. Would you kill it inside the womb? We call it a human right. So he's trying to point out hypocrisy there, but I think his statement that you mentioned in the article and this statement here are actually contrary to one another. But I don't know, what are your thoughts on that? And kind of what is the problem that you saw in general with that quote from your article?
Yeah. So the reason I originally wrote this article sort of directed toward Ben Shapiro is because he is one of the most prominent thought leaders on the conservative right, especially the conservative religious right. And whatever Ben Shapiro says about abortion, that becomes the talking points, particularly for, you know, like the young adult conservatives, the YAF or whatnot, you know, the kids on campus and stuff, the people handing out pamphlets and all that.
Yeah.
So I thought it was really important to engage with him, and I respect him immensely. And I think I've written that elsewhere or said that on my podcast or whatever. I have a great amount of respect for him. I know that he's way smarter than I am just in terms of IQ, but unfortunately, smart people can still be deceived and fall into conventional wisdoms that are just not correct. And this is one of those times. So he's giving the conventional pro-life line and giving further credibility to the conventional pro-life wisdom that women are almost as much a victim of abortion, as it says right there in the quote, and that they cannot be held responsible for their actions because they don't have the mens rea. They don't have the guilty mind. So they can't be held responsible for their actions because their intent to sort of quote unquote rip the baby apart isn't there. And so that's the standard, I think a false standard that he goes on to set up in this interaction. That I think I write about a little bit further down in the article, where it's like, you have to be of the please rip my baby apart mindset in order to be guilty of murder when it comes to abortion. Well, that's completely contrary to the model penal code that most states in America follow with regard to intent. Intent doesn't have to be, I want to rip you to shreds, you know, I want to pull your heart out and eat it. That's not what intent is. Intent simply means that you desire and your mission objective is to have that person terminated or to do it yourself. And the analogy that I like to use that I think is pretty accurate is if you have a mob boss and he tells his henchman, his hitman, I need you to go take that guy out. Doesn't give any more detail than that. Just take him out. Is he guilty of commissioning a murder or not?
Yeah.
That's the position that an abortive woman is in. And I understand that a lot of women, and I've said this so many times, I understand that a lot of women are in really difficult circumstances, in really difficult pregnancies. Sometimes they're in abusive relationships. Sometimes they feel extreme pressure from their parents or from other loved ones that they need to get rid of it. And they feel like they're in a rock and hard place. And suddenly that idea of aborting their child becomes extremely alluring. And then you look at the law and you say, well, look at this has been legal since 1973. This is, you know, suddenly all the talking points start coming to mind and they start feeling more appealing. Well, this is my reproductive right. This is my choice. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court said it's constitutional. This is up to me. It's my decision. And suddenly the law of the land becomes your guide for what is moral and what is not. And that has nothing to do with whether or not you think that what's growing inside of you is a human being or not.
Yeah.
Almost all women, vast majority, they know that it is a human being. They know that sex makes babies, not polyps, not tumors. They understand that. Okay. Like public schools are pretty crappy, but they're not that crappy. Everybody that, you know, reaches that age where they go to sex ed or whatever, they understand that. Or even if you're homeschooled, like you understand that it's a baby that's growing in there, no matter how tiny it is or how undeveloped it is. So this just becomes a question of how do I justify getting rid of this child? And if it helps to dehumanize it, to be like, oh, it's only the size of the tip of a pencil. Oh, you know, it's not a heart. It's not a heart yet. It's just a fetal pole, or whatever it is that you're grasping for to justify what you're doing. You're doing so with the knowledge that it is a human being, and you are grasping at straws to dehumanize that because you already know that. That is a knowledge that you are attempting to suppress in order to justify your decision. Like I said, and like I feel like I always have to say this in this conversation, I'm not talking about women who are being coerced, like truly being coerced by someone into making this terrible decision. I'm talking about the vast majority of women who go into the clinics, who people on the street, the sidewalk people who minister to these women outside of the abortion clinics, they have conversations with them all of the time. And the conversations don't look anything like what Ben Shapiro is representing. They look like, this is my right. The Supreme Court said it's okay. It's not that big of a deal. I've done it before. Just on and on and on. Like, they know it, but they still believe that it is their right to terminate that other human being. That is the problem that we need to focus on. And Shapiro's endorsement of this conventional wisdom is really getting in the way of having that important conversation and of tackling those arguments that are coming from the pro-abortion side that says, well, yeah, I mean, yes, we know it's a human being, right? And that's the other thing that keeps getting left out. It's like we're having this conversation 30 years ago, but the pro-abortion side has already moved on. They're like, but it's still your right because it's your autonomy that's at stake. Yeah. And you can't have somebody, you know, forcefully using your womb against your will. So those are the arguments that are being made right now. And people like Shapiro and other leaders of the pro-life movement are totally missing that because they're using this incorrect and outdated understanding of, you know, what the mens rea really is of women who abort.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think you hit on pretty much everything there. That was excellent. Man, and there's so many things, so many places we could go from there. So one of the things you hit on was, being coerced. One of the things that I think kind of exacerbates this problem is that places like Live Action and even like LifeSite News, just pretty much any media driven company that's in the pro-life movement. There was a time, I want to say it was about a year and a half ago, where they all latched on to this statistic from a study where it said 64% of women are coerced, or at least that's how they portrayed it. 64% of women are not coerced. In fact, what the study said is they felt pressured by others. Right. Which is such a broad range of things. Like, you can literally be, my best friend thinks that I should do it, and that's felt pressured by others. Like, that would have been included. So that kind of speaks to the fact of what you're saying, that they're not, that most of these women are actually not coerced, or at least we have no evidence that they are. And on top of that, like you said, and it's these two things kind of frustrate me, and it makes me think that a lot of people are being disingenuous. Of course, this is my own personal opinion. I'm not saying this is yours, but that combined with the fact that, like, when Ben Shapiro says that, fine, he said something. In fact, let me look at the quote one more time, because exactly what I can get exactly what he says. In that quote I read earlier, he says, "Where is it?" Maybe it's not in that quote, but he says something along the lines of, if you can find me a woman who's walking into abortion clinic that says, I know it's a baby, I don't care it's a baby, I'm still going to kill it, then we have mens rea. And I don't, either he's truly ignorant to the fact that that's a lot of women that walk in to get abortions, or right, he's being disingenuous. And the fact that, combined with how they push these different stats, it's hard for me to not think they're being disingenuous. And that's one of the things kind of disheartening about this whole thing, is because I just don't get why they're lying about this. There's no reason to lie. people already.
I would push back on that, actually. I don't think that Shapiro is being disingenuous. I don't really think he has a disingenuous bone in his body. He said some pretty unpopular things on other issues, you know, like the Civil Rights Act and things like that. But I think that it is his reliance on third-hand information from the pro-life movement that has sort of been filtered down into very purified and simplified talking points. Mm-hmm. And he's relying on that, and he is trusting other people in this movement who he believes have a intimate knowledge of what's going on in order to inform his opinions. So I think that this is more an issue of him trusting others to give him accurate and an authentic picture of what's going on. And he's not getting that. And I think maybe you talked with James Silberman once about this, but there's a big difference between what people who run crisis pregnancy centers see and what people mm-hmm. see who are witnessing to these women outside of the abortion mills. The people who come into the pregnancy centers are the ones who don't want to abort. They're facing pressure, but they're like, I got to get help. I've got to find resources. I've got to find people who will support me in this. So you're getting a totally different picture than the women who are going into the abortion mills without a second thought, really, and being like, yes, please rip it out of me. It's like you said, like they do say things like this. And if you go on Reddit, you can find some really disturbing things about women who have had abortions and how they process what they've done. You know, there's abortion tattoos that women get to memorialize their abortions. They know that they're babies, and they're like, well, you know, this is what I'll get to commemorate what I did and why I did it. So there's a big disconnect between the people who are running the pregnancy centers, which I think is necessary work. I know that there's been a lot of criticism from the abolitionist movement of the pregnancy centers and the tactics that they use and the kind of counseling that they give. And maybe some of that is warranted. I don't want to go into depth in that. But mm-hmm. it's important work that they're doing. You just have to realize that there's a scope to what you're seeing, and you're not seeing the whole picture. That's the problem, is like people, they don't realize that they have blinders on. Mm-hmm. They don't realize that other people are seeing things that are totally different. They're just seeing a couple pieces of the puzzle. And so we really need to zoom out and look at the whole thing and realize, what are the real problems? What are the arguments that we're facing right now? Like I mentioned earlier about, yes, I know it's a baby, but it's still my right to kill it because I have the right to autonomy. And what are the fundamental truths, the fundamental biblical truths, of what's going on, what is just, and what would God have us do? Those are the things that we need to be focusing on. But there's too much of, oh, well, I found this statistic and I found that statistic, and I'm kind of just so going to, you know, I found this example of, you know, these 17 women in El Salvador who were allegedly falsely imprisoned because they had miscarriages for doing legal abortions, you know, and you just sort of cobble it all together to sort of keep your conventional wisdom, comprehensible to the public. Yeah. And it's really sad. It's like, no, just zoom out. What is true? What isn't true? And what pieces of the puzzle are you missing? I don't think that's too much to ask.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you make a good point there. To that point. Well, sort of to that point. So there's a organization called Let Them Live. I don't know if you've heard of them. I think they're a little bit smaller, but they help women get resources that were thinking about abortion. I think they're kind of like a mediator between crisis pregnancy centers. Mm-hmm. They had put out a tweet once saying that 657,000 women per year say that the reason they aborted was because they didn't have financial resources essentially to take care of the child. Now, mm-hmm. again, this is where I get back to some of these people being disingenuous, because they know that study and they read it. And I understand your perspective. And I think you're probably right when it does come to people like Ben Shapiro, that they're taking cues from certain people in the pro-life movement and trusting that they're giving them reliable information. But as you say, this number is kind of disingenuous, because they know that that study is actually not a study that says, why do you get abortion? A, B, C, D, and 74% of people picked B, which was financial reasons, right? It's a study that says, why did you get abortion? And they give you a whole bunch of reason, and you can pick as many as you want. So right. 74 might've said abortion, but also 47 said, well, I just don't want to be a mom. Right. So that 74, that's only one factor in why they got it. And that doesn't necessarily mean the whole thing, but to move on from that.
You can always have more money. Okay. So I'm pregnant with my third. You can always say, gee, it would be nice to have more money. Gee, it would be nice to have a bigger minivan or a nicer, more reliable minivan. It would be nice to live closer to schools. Mm-hmm. And it would be nice to have more of a cushion in the bank account. But in reality, think about it. Almost half of all American births are on Medicaid anyway. So this idea that you just can't cobble together the resources to carry on your pregnancy and give birth and take care of that child, it's ridiculous. We have tons and tons of resources and government programs that are explicitly for helping women and their children. It's called WIC, Women, Infant, Children.
Yeah.
Like there's so many of these things that it just, you can't. And it's funny that conservatives do this. They're like, oh my gosh, like look at all these bloated welfare programs and blah, blah, blah. But then, oh, look at over here and these poor women, and they don't feel like they have the financial resources to take care of their children. It's like, can you have just a little bit of intellectual honesty here and consistency? And it's not there.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of my issue with this. So I've challenged them on this before a couple of times, and they finally answered the last time I did. And with bringing up the actual study that they're citing. And then also I asked them, so what percentage of women do you offer financial services? And they say, no, I'm still going to get abortion. And now keep in mind, this is an organization that's called Let Them Live. Like they're explicitly pro-life. So people come to them are questioning whether they're getting an abortion, but are probably leaning more towards not getting one and trying to find help. They said about 30% don't take the resources and still get an abortion. And I'm like, well, that means that debunks this entire narrative that the reason that 657,000 women a year are getting abortion is because they don't have money. Obviously there's other factors at stake here. But I can't even remember why I brought that up, but anyway, I think you make an excellent point there that there's plenty of resources out there, and this idea that women can't find resources doesn't really make any sense. Cause if you're poor enough to where you literally can't have children too, you know about the welfare programs, you already know about them. So it's not, you know, it's just not a great argument. But one more point to kind of hit on what you had said earlier. You were talking about how women, that it's kind of silly to say that women don't know what they're doing. You know, you're talking about the mens rea, and I agree with that for another reason too, that just out of curiosity, when I was talking about this subject with somebody, I was like, I wonder what age women get abortions on average. And if I remember right, it was about 97 to 98% of women who get abortions are 18 years or older. And I think it was like 92% or 93% were 20 years or older. And that just even further speaks to that, because I've had discussions with people where they say, well, here goes this study that shows 23% of pro-choice women don't think it's a baby. And I'm like, I don't believe them. Because if you are 20 years old and you don't understand that sex creates an offspring that is human, that's completely unbelievable. I can't even entertain that idea. I just think people are,
there's a parsing of the word there. And there's like a delineation that's being made that I think, goes over a lot of pro-lifers' heads. And that is when women say it's not a baby, they're not saying they don't think it's human. They just think it's not a person. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's going on here. It's personhood theory. It's like they're denying the personhood of that human being, which is really disgusting and really abhorrent and something that harkens back to slavery. That's the delineation. And I don't know how you can miss that if you're really paying attention and you really care about this subject. I think maybe you're right. Like generally speaking, not including Ben Shapiro, but generally speaking, there's some like willful ignorance maybe of not wanting to process that these women don't, it's not that they don't think it's a baby, it's they don't think it's a person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a good point. That's probably what they're alluding to, which is sometimes whenever when I discuss this with actual pro-lifers who I know think it's a person, I really try to emphasize, like, I keep the language super specific. So like, they know these are human beings and they still try to refute on that basis. But you're right. It's largely an argument over personhood, because as you said before, and I'll see a lot of pro-choicers that don't understand their positions very well argue that it's just a clump of cells, you know, that sort of thing. But as you said before, the argument is over personhood, because the pro-choice movement, the pro-abortion movement, including like people at Planned Parenthood, the people who are the activists, they will openly admit that, yes, we know it's a baby. Yes, we know it's killing. Or maybe at least, yes, we know it's a human being. We know it's killing. There was that famous video from one of the pro-life conferences, and that was kind of behind closed doors. But even now, it's out in the open. You talk to abortion doctors, they'll go, yes, of course it's a human being. It's just that we have bodily autonomy. My body, my choice. I have the right to not let something grow inside of me if I don't want to.
Right.
But yeah. And there was another piece that you wrote, and you kind of hit on this a minute ago, so maybe we won't dig into this too much, but where'd it go? Oh, there it goes. Nope, I lost it. Where'd my article go? I had one of your articles pulled up. I don't know. Maybe if for some reason we end up hitting back on abortion again, I'll come back to it. But I have no idea what happened to it. Okay, but anyway. So let's jump into some of the COVID stuff then, since I fumbled that one. So you've written a few pieces that are related to COVID. Some, I think, are related to COVID that you may have not intended to be related to COVID, actually. But I think there's a lot of stuff that's happening right now is an effect of the shutdowns and the mask wearing and just the fear in general and the churches closing and all that sorts of thing. But the first thing I wanted to hit on was related to the churches closing. You had written a piece. Well, I guess maybe we'll do this backwards. So Great Community Church in California, the main pastor being John MacArthur, recently defied the state and decided to open back up. But before that, they were making they admitted to changing their mind, essentially, which is awesome because you don't see people do this a lot. As you said, it's credit to the Holy Spirit working in people's hearts to change their mind and causing them to be open to recognize whenever they're wrong about something. But their position before was basic Romans 13 position, which is basically that essentially we're supposed to obey the state unless the state is telling us to do something immoral, and because the churches have some say, and when we don't meet for worship because of things like a virus, like your elders can get together and say, you know what, this seems like like it's too dangerous, we're going to hold off for a few weeks, because the elders do have the authority to do that as the overseers of the church, that therefore it is not a sin in that case to temporarily stop services. And therefore, if the government tells us to, they're not telling us to sin. So therefore we should stop. But could you just kind of give me your overall problem with like the Romans 13 argument that was being made by John MacArthur back then?
Yeah. So for the audience, I'll just read the couple verses really quickly from Romans 13. Mm-hmm. I have it embedded in my article. It's, therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed. And those who resist will incur judgment. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good and you will receive his approval, for he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is a servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. And there's a similar text in 1 Peter 2, which is, you know, you need to be obedient to the authorities, even when it seems like it's not fair. And so that's the general position is, okay, we need to take a very literal and eisegetical view and sort of isolate this text and treat it very literally as a blanket call to do whatever the government says or stop doing whatever the government says you have to stop to do, because otherwise you're disobeying God because the authorities were appointed by God. So that was generally the position that John MacArthur was taking. And you can read in his notes of faith from even mid-May. He infers that there's like this distinction between rules for the general welfare of the public that Christians are obligated to adhere to, hence his previous position of we need to stop doing church until the government says it's okay. And he makes a distinction between that and rules that target Christians. For instance, like in Acts 5, 27 through 29, you know, Peter was charged not to preach the name of Jesus, but he was like, he told the Sanhedrin, we must obey God rather than men. So he makes like this distinction there that I think he was really, really relying on. But then he seems to have realized that that kind of falls apart upon closer scrutiny, because that distinction in terms of obedience and non-obedience to authorities doesn't really exist in the Bible. It's like you're supposed to do what God has called you to do and what the scriptures tell you to do. And if the government tells you, regardless of whether it has to do with them persecuting you, if the government tells you to do something that's not that, that's against that, then obviously you obey God rather than men. So I think he's come to this conclusion that, you know, that the distinction could no longer be held up, and it didn't actually make any sense. And I know that, you know, he's a great man of faith, and he's influenced a lot of people in very positive ways in their walk with Christ. And I want to make sure that everybody knows that. Like, when I wrote this article, I was not like, oh, boo John MacArthur. He's so horrible. He's like leading all of these people astray. I was like, no, I think he's really mistaken in this. And if you take a good look at the context and the logic behind the scriptures that most people are talking about with regard to obeying civil authorities, you come out with the understanding that this is the realm of what happens in the church is up to, you know, what the scriptures say and what the elders have prayerfully considered based off of the leadings of the Holy Spirit. And that has nothing to do with what the government says you can or cannot do. That's irrelevant. And just as an aside, I think it's really interesting, and I think it was erroneous for so many Christians to immediately rely on the constitutional argument instead of the biblical argument, because we're quickly approaching a point in this country where the Constitution is just, it's just going to be irrelevant. Yeah. It will just be a document that was in the past that has no bearing on current reality. And we've already seen this start to unravel. So when Christians were saying for the past 5 months, oh, I have a constitutional right to assemble, you know, separation of church and state, which, you know, that phrase isn't in the Constitution, but that's generally what people are relying on. And it's like, you know, so it doesn't matter what Jay Inslee says or what Andrew Cuomo says or Bill de Blasio, I can still meet because it's my constitutional right. And it's like, is the Constitution has not been relevant to anything these governors have been doing. So why would you think that that's going to save you now? Really, you need to be relying on the Bible, and you need to be relying on Christ. And what is your responsibility as a Christian with regard to gathering? And it says in Hebrews 10, it says, do not neglect meeting together as some are in the habit of doing. But, you know, all the more as you see the day of the Lord drawing near. I'm sort of paraphrasing. But so we have a clear command in the Bible that we're supposed to be meeting together, and, you know, we're supposed to be taking the Lord's Supper, baptizing people, which, you know, doesn't have to be done during church service, but it usually is in most churches. And, you know, the laying on of hands, praying for one another, like this stuff all happens in church and the gathering together and the breaking of bread. So you can't just throw all of that out the window because the government says that COVID is a problem. So this is something that is the responsibility of the church to do what is biblical and to do what is right in the eyes of the Lord. And the legal consequences, you know, you got to leave that up to God.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And to the point about the constitutional argument, you end up, when that's all you're focused on, you end up in these ridiculous conversations, like what happened, like the argument that Jonathan Lehman was making, where it's, he's essentially saying that, that the elders shouldn't feel like, because of John MacArthur's decision, that they are now forced to meet. And then whenever you kind of question him on it, you're like, well, you know, they're allowing protest, you know, and that's because he's kind of making an argument that they're treating us all the same, which is somehow based in the Constitution as well. And you start looking at it, you go, well, they're allowing protests, which are categorically more similar to church than random businesses. And so my point being, you just get caught up in these bizarre conversations. And really the core of the issue is, what is the authority of the state? What is the authority of the church? What is the authority of the family? What is the authority of the individual? And once you find those distinctions, then it becomes a lot clearer. And the only argument that I've seen, and this is also from Lehman, where he was arguing that there's an overlap, though. And so I kind of want to get your thoughts on this. He's saying there's an overlap. He said, for instance, between the family and in the state, there's an overlap. Like, you can't abuse your child, right? But you can discipline mm-hmm. your child. And so he's saying that, like, but he's trying to make this false dichotomy, at least the way I see it, where it's there's discipline, 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 discipline. And then right here, it becomes abuse. But we don't really know if it's abuse or discipline for this, like, varying degree, like, you know, that crosses the line on one side or the other. And so therefore mm-hmm. there's like some nuance at a certain point. Whereas I don't agree with that statement at all. I think there is a hard line. And the fact that we are not able to judge the hard line does not mean that there isn't a hard line. You know what I mean? In any particular circumstance, at mm-hmm. least, there is a hard line. Right. So it's not that there's overlap in, like, the government gets to decide how you discipline. No, it's that eventually your discipline is no longer discipline. So that's the only other point I've seen somebody try to make where they weren't just arguing from a constitutional basis, but were actually arguing from a sphere of authority basis.
Right. Well, the authority, you know, that God has granted to civil authorities is like, you know, for, it's supposed to be for your good, right? It's supposed to be, you know, to punish the evildoer. Well, if the parent has been abusing their child, which by the way, doesn't always have to do with discipline. There are many other forms of abuse that take place.
I would argue
then they're carrying out their duty that they've been given by God to punish the evildoer. So that's, I think you're right that there's very distinct spheres there, and that's not really a matter of nuance. That's just what the Bible says.
Yeah, there's no, it's not, to me, it's not even like it's not that something goes over in, that here's discipline and then it goes over into abuse. I think they're categorically two different things. And just because someone isn't able to make the rational distinction between whether what they're doing is discipline or abuse doesn't mean they're not completely different. Doesn't mean they're not completely distinct from one another. And there's mm-hmm. basically my point being that Jonathan Lehman was trying to make the argument that there's like an overlap, and that the government has to decide where to step in during that overlap. And I argue there's no overlap. You have abuse and you have discipline, and they are two entirely different things. And depending mm-hmm. upon the context, the government has a right to step in because it is abuse, or they don't because it is discipline. But anyway.
Which, how does that even translate into COVID and the churches? Like, the government has a right to step in and say, you can't baptize people, you can't lay on hands because you have to keep 6 feet of distance. Like, I don't even see how that really translates to that issue, because the biblical mandate is so clear. And because the authority of the elders is so clear in regards to what happens in the church versus what happens in general society, that the civil authorities are charged with taking care of.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's not, it doesn't, even if you were to able to argue there was some overlap between, what do you call it, the nuance between what is the sphere of authority of the church versus what is the sphere of authority of the state when it comes to meeting for worship and what you do during worship is so drastically different that it's not even close in comparison to what is discipline versus what is abuse. But
right.
But yeah, so I guess continuing on kind of the COVID stuff, there's a piece you wrote called How White Privilege Theory Encouraged Destruction of Property. And I can't remember, I read this a few days ago, so I can't remember if you had mentioned the COVID situation in here or not. But I think whether you realize it or not, what you're writing it, this actually relates quite a bit to the COVID situation. Because in here, let me see if I can find it real quick.
Well, I think that these protests, I mean, the reason we're seeing this unrest largely has to do with the severity and the length of the lockdowns and how that influenced people mentally. And then they see this this opportunity to go out and be with people and do something exciting and get loud and break all of the rules. And that is very, very appealing to people who have been incredibly lonely and locked in their homes for a very long time. And this goes hand in hand with all pandemics in the past. It's followed by violence. So this follows that pattern, but as I discuss in the article, it's not just like random acts of violence or opportunistic vandalism. There is a heavy ideological component that is driving this and sort of harnessing all of that pent-up energy of people who have been trapped at home and very lonely into all of this, the violence and the rioting and the arson and the vandalism and all of that.
Yeah. And I might've been thinking of a different article, but you had said something along the lines of talking about the economic, the further economic disparity that it was going to cause because, well, first of all, a lot of people before the lockdowns have pretty secure jobs or they have enough money in the bank. They don't have to worry about it. And so what you end up with is, well, we need to lock everything down. So that hurts more so the middle class and lower class who have jobs that are going to be lost and then don't have any income back to help. And then that kind of flows into the white privilege theory, because a lot of those people, the people that are going to be more affected. In fact, I think I saw a study recently that was done that showed it was some ridiculously high number, like 70% of the businesses that are closed were minority owned businesses. So now you end up with a situation like that. Like you said, you have a bunch of people sitting around not doing anything. And then on top of that, a lot of those people are people that were lower or middle class anyway, that now don't have enough money to feed themselves. And then a lot of those people on top of that, as we've seen from statistics of what businesses are closing down, end up being minorities. And then on top of that, you just have this spark of the BLM stuff.
Yeah, it's a perfect storm. I think what you're referring to was what I wrote way back in April about the emerging public health crisis that was going to be the result of the lockdowns, which people like several weeks later were like, musing on Twitter and writing think pieces on, gee, I think this is a problem. And I'm like, how did you not see this weeks and weeks ago? Like, this seemed so obvious to me. But once again, I'm like ahead of the curve. And so nobody paid attention when I wrote this back in April, but everybody started paying attention to the other articles in May when they started seeing these things bearing out in real life, like the increased substance abuse, you know, suicide ideation, things like that. But I said, we are in an unprecedented situation. Unemployed and employed may emerge temporarily as the greatest societal divide. Whether that divide is an effect of envy, social tension, lower access to healthcare, a combination, or something else, it could worsen health outcomes considerably. And what I had mentioned previously in that article was there's studies that say not only does unemployment itself lead to worse health outcomes, even in the long term, not just as far as suicide is concerned, which is like the worst of that usually happens between 15 and 26 weeks, according to one study. That's what they found. So we're like in the thick of it right now. But long term, there's, you know, like heart disease and angina pectoris and hypertension and all of these things that can happen when there's increased inequality. And of course, we're seeing increased inequality. And I know that, you know, for a lot of conservatives, that's like a, that word gets them all like hot and bothered. But it's something that it's fine to talk about. Like there are consequences to that just because of human nature. And I think one of the major consequences is envy. And that in itself leads to poor mental health outcomes, as it turns out, according to another study. So you've got a problem here with the haves and the have nots. And you have this, you know, white privilege, sort of anti-racist ideology, Marxist ideology being inserted into that wedge right there, and just broadening that gap and making it more and more tense. And just it's reached an explosive point. And so that's why the ideology matters so much more than just like, oh yeah, you know, we're following a pattern. This violence was to be expected, something or other was gonna set it off. Like, we've been heading down this road for a while as far as the ideology is concerned.
Yeah. A friend of mine, Jacob Brunton, I talked to him about Black Lives Matter and stuff a while back. And he had spoken about, I asked him, like, what is different about this George Floyd case? And of course, I think it's some of the stuff we talked about just now with the with everybody being at home and the further economic disparity because people hadn't worked for a couple months and all that stuff as well. But also he pointed to the same thing you just did, that this Marxist or white privilege, you know, white, you know,
oppressor,
intersectionality.
Yeah.
Ideology has been slowly gaining traction. And over a period of time you had Michael Brown incident and that lit a spark, but there wasn't enough fuel. And then you had, you know, the next incident, little spark, the next incident, little spark. And then you come to this George Floyd thing. And it's kind of like you have the perfect storm of all this stuff. And you have the Marxist ideology finally seeping into enough people's heads, even if they don't know it's Marxist ideology. They're accepting the underlying principles or ideas behind it. And finally, that spark lit. And that combined with all the COVID stuff just threw everything in or just set everything on fire. Yeah. And as far as like the, you wrote an interesting piece as well on the, speaking to the mental health stuff on the, on kids wearing masks. Yeah. There's no reason to mask toddlers was the title of it. And I would take that further. I think there is a mental health aspect to pretty much anybody wearing a mask. I mean, on the mask scale that we are, of course, where everybody's masking up for no reason at all for what I think are rather dubious reasons. I think even if you search on Google, in fact, I'll do it real quick. See, why wear a mask?
To protect everyone else.
Yeah, here we
That's
go.
That's the talking point.
I forget what I searched before. Let's put for COVID. Google had a thing that was popping up at the top for a while that I don't see it now. But anyway, it basically said, okay, here we go. Mask absorb droplets when sneeze or cough, but face shields do not. If you choose to wear a face shield over a mask, yada. So it's basically saying that, like, that's not the exact one I was thinking of. But basically, they had a thing saying that, like, the reason why you wear a mask is because if you sneeze or cough and droplets come out, it catches the droplets. And I go,
right.
Okay. So what if you're not sneezing or coughing? And so there's just like this element where it's like, to me, it's.
No, we actually saw, when we went to visit Mount Rushmore a few weeks ago, there's this lady who had her mask on. She took her mask off and she had some other things in her hands, sneezed into the open air and then put her mask back on. So because good. Nobody wants to wear a mask that's been sneezed in.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You're going to want to change practical, it immediately.
There are like even just like practical reasons why this is just like such a dumb reason to wear a mask.
Yeah.
Because the public is not going to observe all of those things that the surgeons are observing when they're wearing their mask.
And by the way, that was the argument being made by the experts, by Fauci and them, whenever they were saying, no, don't go out and buy them. You're going to waste the mask. We need them for surgeons. But the main argument they said is they don't work. That's what he said is they don't work for general right. public because of X, Y, and Z factors. And that was one of them that he listed. And he listed a couple of other ones. And then a lot of doctors that were going around doing podcasts were saying, well, yeah, they don't work for that. But also, like, they don't stop in the air. Like, you're still breathing out the air and it's seeping out the sides. And they're like, so it doesn't stop the actual airflow of the virus if it's, you know, spreading by air very easily. So the only thing it stops is sneezes and coughs. But like you said, and like Fauci said back then, before it was like everybody must wear a mask, it doesn't work. It doesn't work because there's too many factors involved. But even if it does.
Yeah. Well, going back to what you said, that like there's a cost, a mental health cost, and an extreme social cost to wearing a mask. Like I've had people tell me like, oh, you know what? There's really no downside to wearing a mask. It's just common courtesy. Just do it for other people to make them feel comfortable. It's like opening a door for somebody. And I'm thinking to myself, like, I go to the grocery store and I have to wear a face covering. I take my kids with me to the grocery store. They're 3.5 and 14 months. They can't see my face.
Yeah.
My kids, small children that rely on me and my facial expressions for assurances, for guidance, for, you know, to figure out like what exactly I'm saying, they can't see my face.
Yeah.
That in itself is just a big deal. You're putting a wedge, not just between households, but between members of the same household who are out and about because you think that, you know, that this is a miracle worker and is going to drive down COVID cases, which it doesn't seem like that's been the case. I don't think that reality has really borne that out. So there's costs to this, and especially masking your toddlers. My goodness, I'm not going to put a smothering blanket over my toddler when all other medical guidance says, please don't put blankets over your children's heads. I'm not gonna do that for no reason because children don't spread COVID in any statistically significant manner, particularly, you know, infants and toddlers. They just don't. But there is a pressure here, an immense social pressure to wear masks, to engage in the virtue signaling so that you can conform and you can be accepted. And so you just deal with it because you feel like you're going to be the odd one out. You know, if you're lucky enough to live in a state where it's not mandated that you wear them everywhere, like I am, you know, there's pressure to do that. Even in states where, you know, it's not mandated for kids under 5 to wear masks, I see people all of the time put masks on kids who are under 5 years old when there's literally no reason to do that except to virtue signal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Why would you do that to your child? That I feel like that's selfish. And I don't think parents think of it that way. But I don't think that they fully thought through the consequences of their actions. It's very, very uncomfortable and frustrating to wear a mask, especially if you're a little kid and you're putting all that frustration on yourself too. If your kid keeps ripping off of their mask, why would you even want to deal with that? Like, as a parent, that sounds terrible. Like, if I put, like, my toddler probably would wear a mask if I put a mask on her because, you know, she's just that kind of kid, but there are lots of other kids who don't want to do that. So why would you even put that on yourself just to virtue signal? That doesn't seem right.
Yeah, my kid is having none of it. He doesn't have to wear a mask. Luckily, we're in Texas. It's not as bad here. They did a mandate. But to be honest, I go over the hell I want. As long as I put the mask on when I walk in the store, I can take it off the second I walk in. Nobody's going to say anything. Well, nobody's going to say anything to me. I've had people have said stuff to my wife whenever I'm not there. But because she wears hers below her nose because she just doesn't want to sit there and breathe in it the whole time. But But nobody's going to say anything to me. So I'm kind of lucky there that I'm to some extent that I'm in Texas. South Dakota, I guess, would be the best place to be. But I don't even remember where I was going with this now.
Well, that's where I'm moving. So.
Oh, you're moving to South Dakota. Ah, yeah. Sweet. That's a good move.
In October.
I'm already in a conservative state, and I've been thinking about maybe we'll move to South Dakota because of all this craziness.
It's beautiful. Yeah, we're moving to Rapid City, and it is beautiful there, and the governor is not a crazy person, and she resists groupthink, which is a highly valuable trait. Mm-hmm. And even if, you know, when she's done being governor, there's still so many other benefits to living there that we were like, we just can't deal with Washington State anymore. We want to just GTF out of here.
Well, yeah. And the other thing is, which this may not have been a problem for you. I don't know what your husband does for a living, but I know you do a lot of, I assume you would do a lot of remote work since you write for the Federalist and that sort of thing. But now, even if you had kind of a job where they kind of, I don't know if we want to do that. Cause even a lot of tech companies where you're, cause I do web development stuff and you look for jobs, tech companies, and a lot of them, no remote. They'll say on the thing. And I'm like, but I'm typing into a computer and sending it to a cloud. Right. What are you doing? But anyway, now that we've hit all this COVID stuff and there's a bunch of ability to do work remote, it makes it even easier to move somewhere like South Dakota, where maybe there's not a ton of jobs out in the middle of nowhere, but we've thought about moving out in East Texas here. There's not a lot of jobs out there, but now so many places have gone remote. And from what I've heard from people that I've talked to, companies actually seem to be looking at it and go, wow, this worked a lot better than we thought it was going to. So I think you're going to have a lot of companies that do not go back. So that's one good thing that's come out of this is the opportunity to do that. But I guess, and this is probably the last thing we'll hit on because we've been going on for about 45 minutes here. But the last thing that just kind of popped in my head whenever you were talking earlier is you were talking about this being just basically a virtue signal. And I think that's exactly true. And people get upset when you say that. But considering the fact that, so for instance, I think a while back, one of the interactions that we had on Twitter was I had shared with you the Department of Public Health for, where was it? I pulled it up here. Was it Illinois? Yeah, Illinois. The director of the Department of Public Health at Illinois had said, I believe the quote was something along the lines of, even if there's a clear alternate cause for someone's death, they still count it as a COVID death. If they tested positive for COVID, they count it as because and Dr. Birx has kind of hinted this too, whenever she says that she was a little more vague about it, where hers could have been left up to interpretation some more. But essentially my point being that, from what I've looked at, and I can't remember where exactly I came to this conclusion, but you could probably knock off about 25% of cases off the bat, as not being actual COVID deaths, clearly not COVID deaths. If you look at some of the, cause I looked at some of what the individual states had done, what they had counted, and then what they had later came back in and said, wait a minute, that's not really a COVID death, and taking it off and that sort of thing. So that's kind of my own assessment. But in general, the point I'm making is that this virus ended up not being nearly as bad as they said it was going to be. And I think that's clear. That's really obvious to everyone, even the people who are pro-mask. And so what frustrates me is that particularly Christians are acting like this argument for masks is about loving your neighbor. David French, for instance, made the completely moronic comparison. My words, not yours, in case you're friends with him. Don't put this on her. But he made this completely moronic and I call stupid decision to compare the logic behind my body, my choice, murdering and dismembering babies, and the logic behind I don't think I should be forced to wear a mask. And you see a lot of this from Christians. And I mean, again, I think much of it is disingenuous because of the obvious evidence in front of our face. And again, it's another one of those things where it's very disappointing to see.
I think there's a lot of groupthink going on.
Yes.
And I do think that we need to be careful in who we believe to be disingenuous and what we can better chalk up to just a massive amount of groupthink and being led around by the nose by fear. And you've seen this all across the world, where public health experts have basically chucked away decades of previous research and wisdom and guidance on what to do during pandemics, because so-and-so did this over here, and we're just going to follow what this country over here did. Mm-hmm. And the World Health Organization says 1 meter. Why don't we just make it 2 meters? Why don't we make it 6 feet of social distance instead, just to be extra safe? Yeah. Like a lot of people who are very smart and generally good in their fields have fallen victim to groupthink and being led by paranoia and by public pressures, and the public hardly knows anything about science mm-hmm. at all, which, so just like, don't even pay attention to polling, please, if you're a public health official. And I think a lot of this is that. And then commentators like David French, who I have a lot of respect for, and I read a lot of what he writes, or at least I used to, they take cues from those people, and the groupthink just like falls down the line like dominoes. And it's just like this really, really ugly effect. And then you get to a point where you accept the conventional wisdom that masks really work, even though there's really no solid conclusive evidence that the way that masks protect you is by, like, you know, catching the sputum, and that's going to reduce transmission. So, you know, David French has obviously accepted that. And then he's gone on to make this silly comparison to my body, my choice. I think that that's more how it works. It's not so much people being deceptive as just like being intellectually lazy. Mm-hmm. I think that's a lot of it. It's just intellectual laziness.
I think I agree with you on that's how it starts. Which I'm not trying to put you on the spot here, so you don't have to comment mm-hmm. on this at all. But I agree with you on that's how it starts. My issue becomes that lots of people are providing rational objections to what they're saying in good faith, and they either completely ignore it, and I know they're seeing these things because these are people that have a big enough following that they see them. They see their objections. And there's people writing articles with objections to these things that have pretty large followings as well. And they see these and they just either ignore them completely and just act like they don't exist, when I know they know they exist. Eric Erickson, I've had him do the same thing. I've seen him do mm-hmm. the same thing. I mean, they ignore it, just act like it doesn't exist. Or they give some sort of answer that, like you said, these are smart people. They give some sort of answer that a not smart person would give. Like that's right. Just not even, that's so far beyond the pale of reason that's so unreasonable and so ridiculous, and ignores the actual core of the argument and answers some random straw man outside of it, that I go, at this point, you know what you're doing. Like, but I think you're right. It does start with just groupthink. And that's why I try not to criticize people who aren't the David French and the Eric Erickson and some of these other people who I followed like 5 years ago before kind of the Trump stuff hit. Cause I think that's when a lot of them started to lose it. And I hated Trump, by the way. And I still think that they started to lose it around that time. But I shouldn't say hate. I extremely disliked Trump and his the things that I thought he was going to do when he got in office, which I was wrong about a lot of it. But I don't even know where I was going with this now. But basically these are people who I know are smart, people who I followed, who I read, who I've seen make rational and really good arguments for things that, like you said, probably got caught up in groupthink, but I think now they've just committed to this idea and they're not willing to go, maybe I was wrong.
There's
about
some pride bound up in it too. You know, once you commit to a position, it's very hard to let go. And I've seen, you know, people even close to me in my personal life who seem to be doing that. You know, once you've committed to a position, it's just really, really hard to let that go. So I think there's a lot of it. And I think that, yeah. And, you know, like as a reader and a consumer of a lot of conservative media, because it's sort of a part of my job, I try and give grace to people in that regard. But when it comes to just like, okay, clearly you didn't do your research, clearly you're being intellectually lazy, I'm like, I'm done. Like, just like you said, like there have been a lot of people that I've sort of written off as not credible because of the way that they approached COVID. And somebody said something really pithy that has stuck with me on Twitter a few months ago. And they said, when the tide goes out, you see who's swimming naked. And I think that that is what we're seeing in the Christian leadership and the conservative leadership. Well, really all leadership. The tide has come out and now you're seeing who's swimming naked and who really is standing on solid evidence and logic and critical thinking and on the word of God and who isn't.
Yeah. And I will say to end this on a positive note, one of the things that I think is actually good that's going to come out of this is I think that conservatives and Christians did have a tendency to, I don't know if idolize is the right word, but hold people to a higher esteem than they should have for quite some time. And some of this is kind of revealing that some of this, well, the only word I can think of is idolizing. So some of this idolization of some of these, you know, pastors, like some of the pastors of the big churches, like even John MacArthur or on the other side of like the social justice type sector, Matt Chandler, or some of these conservative thought leaders like Eric Erickson, David French, even people that were, you know, presidents, you know, George W. Bush, those sorts of people, seeing like how everybody can be extremely unreasonable at certain periods of time. Like you'll see in Christianity, you'll see how that chases people away from the faith sometimes. But when it comes to true Christians, actually what it does is it strengthens your faith because you realize, oh, okay, right. I put too much stock into what my feelings about what that person was saying.
Right. Right. Definitely. I agree.
That's kind of a positive outcome with this. But on that note, I guess I'll go ahead and let you go. If anybody wants to find Georgie, you can find her again, like we said at the beginning of this, at Georgie_Borman on Twitter. You can also find her writing at The Federalist. I'll link all the articles that we talked about on this particular podcast at the bottom. So if y'all want to check those out, I highly recommend it. She does. I think you make some of, like, it was kind of hard to pick. We were kind of all over the place today because it was hard to pick a specific thing because you've written about several different topics over the last year that are kind of related, but not exactly. And I think you've been on point. And like you said earlier, you've been out in the front putting ideas out there, like with when John MacArthur first came out and said, Romans 13, we're not opening up. Like with the mental health effects with COVID and stuff like that. You've kind of been ahead of the curve, as you said, on a lot of these things. So I think y'all should definitely check out her writing at The Federalist. Is there anything else you have upcoming? I know you said your podcast is on hiatus right now, but is there anything else you have upcoming that are coming up that you think would be of interest?
Hopefully when my morning sickness subsides, I'll be back to writing again. I'll be writing more about the pandemic, more about the gaslighting and moving the goalposts and things in that regard. But thank you so much for having me. I think this has been a really interesting conversation.
Awesome. Thank you for coming on.